Well, I have to say it's completely true that I love Berkeley. So it's really a great pleasure for me to be here again at Berkeley University. But it's also a great pleasure to see that when we're talking about women's rights, global challenge, there's a lot of men. So I think that's a very, that speaks very well of Berkeley, I have to say, of the Berkeley spirit. And as Beatrice Mantz mentioned, I'm here now in this new capacity of Undersecretary General and Executive Director of this entity. This is a new entity that's probably the first baby of the UN reform, because it's, you know, the UN is going through a reform trying to be much more effective, and this new baby has a very long name. It's called Entity for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment. So that brings you a moment without breath, so it's called UN Women. It's much more easy. And the few men, because I have to be honest, that work with us, there's no gender parity in UN Women still. They say, okay, don't worry, it's UN We Men. So everybody is very happy about the name. But I have to tell you that I'm reminded daily of the potential inherent in every members of society, women and men, boy and girls. And I have seen myself that when afforded the opportunity, there is no limit to what women can do. From women who support their families in the hardest circumstances. And I have been less than 10 days ago, a week ago maybe, in a refugee camp in Kenya, 8 miles from Somalia. This is mainly a Somali refugee camp. And you could talk to women there, some of them living for more than 20 years, flowing away from violence in Somalia. Some other who were born there, and some other who have lived for many years, and some others, because every month still is receiving 10,000 refugees every month, new refugees. And you see those women working hard. But also you can see women who become Minister of Finance, of Foreign Affairs, of Head of State. And so women's strength, women industry, women wisdom are, I think, humankind, greatest untapped resource. The challenge then for you and women is to show our different diverse constituencies how this resource can be effectively tapped in ways that benefit us all. Tapping this potential, the incredible potential, because you know, usually when we speak of women, we speak of the gaps, we speak of exclusion, we speak of, I'm talking in the world, lack of opportunities. And all of that is true. And we need to protect women from those situations. And we need to give them a chance, give them opportunities. But on the other hand, I believe that women are extraordinary agents of development, agents of change, agents of peace. And I have seen so many great cases on that. So we really need to tap all this incredible potential. And that means involves bringing women into decision making. It means creating space for their leadership. It involves freeing women from gender-based violence and providing the avenues and opportunities for them to be recognized as subjects of rights, but also as economic actors and included in economic policy making. It involves also showing policymakers that where women are fully contributing to their societies, everyone benefits. And I'm determined that UN Women will be a catalyst for change, offering new energy, drawing on long-standing ideas and values, and bringing together men and women from different countries, societies, and communities in a shared endeavor. UN Women's vision is one where women and men have equal opportunities and capacities, and the principles of gender equality are embedded in development, peace, and security agenda. And our key objective is to be able to build national capacity and ownership to enable national partners, and when I'm talking about national partners, I'm talking about governments, but also I'm talking about women's organizations, civil society, universities, grassroots organizations, and so on, to enable them to formulate gender-responsive laws and policies and to be able to scale up successful strategies to deliver on national commitments to gender equality. Because of course, we'll be working globally, because we have a global mandate. There are many of the gaps and many of the problems that women face in the world that are widespread all over the world. But on the other hand, the difference we'll be making at the country level, where you can introduce the laws, the policies, the strategies that really will be able to progress in terms of gender equality and women's empowerment. And to meet all these objectives, we'll center our work around five core principles. First, providing demand-driven support to national partners to enhance implementation of international agreements and standards. I don't know if you know, we have already a lot of international standards. There is the CEDAW, that's the Convention Against Discrimination and All Kinds of Exclusion of Women. There's a lot of standards, values, and principles there. There's a lot of countries, of the 192 countries of the United Nations. I believe that it's almost 182 of the 192 that have signed this convention that should be fulfilling all this commitment. But we also have the Beijing Platform for Action that also states clearly which are the commitments of the countries in terms of gender equality and women's empowerment. So we do have those agreements and standards, but to say the truth, not everywhere those commitments are really implemented. As a matter of fact, in the US, still CEDAW is not ratified. It is right now in Parliament, but I don't know if it will be possible for it to be ratified. Well, and I mentioned demand-driven because we really believe that in terms of getting important gender equality and women's empowerment, countries have to feel the ownership of the policies. They have to take into consideration their own culture, their own kinds of organizations. So that's why we said demand-driven. Governments or women's organizations ask us for finance, funds, technical support, or whatever, and we help them. And we have been helping a lot in many different countries in developing, for example, laws against domestic violence in many places. In other places, we have been working with organizations that ask us to give them legal support in terms of quota laws or different kinds of laws that was necessary to implement. The second principle is to support intergovernmental processes to strengthen the global normative and policy framework on gender equality. This very strange phrase means that we work with all the countries in all the different, forms of organization of the United Nations to mainstream gender issue in all the different policies. So if we discuss education, it's education how it will affect women and girls. If we discuss this year, for example, the Commission Statute of Women, the theme was how education and technology can improve women's and girls' lives. And next year it will be how we improve the livelihoods of women working and living in the rural area. So there's lots of moments where countries get together, discuss and elaborate standards, but also commitments. Well, the third thing is to advocate for gender equality and women's empowerment, championing the rights of women and girls, particularly, I mean, of all, but of course particularly, those who are the most excluded ones. Fourth is leading and promoting coherence in the UN system work on gender equality, because UN Women is a new entity formed by four former entities. It's giving now more power. It's supposed to receive more resources, but I read in the newspaper that we will have $500 million. When I accepted the position, I learned that I have to fundraise all that money. Well, that's why. And that's my problem. I never ask those kind of things before. I decide that when the mission is noble, I just say, yes, I have to work on that. But it's okay, that's my character. It's a nice thing to do, to fundraise for a so important noble cause. But on the other hand, it means that the rest of the system is not, I mean, we won't replace them. they cannot say, okay, there is an entity who works with women, we're not going to work with women anymore. On the contrary, UNDP, that's the United Nations Development Program, has to do much more for women in development. UNICEF had to continue working on girls and do much more. FAO, you know, the Fund for Agriculture, Organization on Agriculture, has to do much more on agriculture and women and so on. So we are the ones who had to be coordinating, producing synergies, but also have to make accountable the rest. But we said we won't be the gender police, we'll be more the friends who will be given policy guidance than gender police. Well, the fifth issue is try to act as a global broker, if I may say, use that word, of knowledge and experience, because we try to align good practices with normative guidance. And in that term, I believe we need to build very important networks with universities, because there's a lot of research needed. There's a lot of experience in the universities that we need to bring together and see which are good, successful strategies, good practices, and how we can share with some countries to another which are the best possible ways to respond to many of these challenges. And the challenges we're facing are daunting. Women's rights in many parts of the world are not guaranteed. In many places, they are treated as second-class citizens. In some, they're not even considered citizens. In some countries of the world, women still cannot vote. Can you believe that? And the figures are clear, just to mention some of them. 60 or 70%, because I've heard different studies, of the poor of the world are women and girls. 70% of the illiterate of the world are female. 80% of the human trafficking leading to sexual slavery or labor slavery are women and girls in the world. 80 to 85% of the agricultural forces in many countries of Africa are women, but only 2% have land rights, and many do not have the right to inherit. In many countries of Africa, if the husband dies, and it has been the place where they have lived their whole life, their work together, and usually women are the ones who are the labor force at the agriculture, they have to leave, because the one who inherits is the son. If the woman has only girls, daughters, she will have to leave. Otherwise, they will give the land to the brother of the husband or an uncle and so on. So there's a lot of situations that really mean a lot of obstacles for women's opportunities. Despite the predominance of women in the agricultural sector in many regions, the OECD data shows that of the $8.4 billion that were spent on agricultural aid between 2002 and 2008, donors reported that just 5.6% included focus on gender. If we talk about health, well, we all know what's going on. I mean, 350,000 women die every year due to pregnancy and birth complication. And also, if we see the trend of HIV/AIDS in Africa, it has the face of a woman or a girl. Rape is a common situation in conflict countries and post-conflict countries. But less than 5% of post-conflict funds are devoted to women's empowerment and gender equality. Violence against women in all its forms, domestic violence, rape, early marriage, child rights, forced marriage, FGM, you know what FGM is, yeah? Female genital mutilation, or cutting, is widespread, and at least 40% of women in the world has said that they, I mean, at least 40% of the women in the world have said that they have experienced gender-based violence at least once in their lifetime. So if we're talking about situation, that is some of the figures I can share with you. But also, if we think of the huge gaps in wealth and income that have accompanied economic growth, have deepened since the economic and financial crisis, and pushed millions of workers, especially women, into permanent informal employment. Both political conflict and natural disasters are driving fuel and food prices, threatening livelihoods and food security in many countries and straining household coping strategies. And this does not have to be the case. I mean, this is what's happening, but we can't change that. Politicians and policymakers from all political parties can be persuaded that things can be managed better so that we can keep our country safe and our economies prospering by investing in the future, building stronger safety nets, guaranteeing basic physical and social protection for everyone. I mean, I don't want to depress you. I just wanted to share with you some of the reality of many women. But there are some progress too. We have seen progress. Over 120 countries have adopted national plans for action for gender equality, and at least 132 countries have a legislative provision to combat domestic violence. The only issue is that I believe in all the progress that we've seen in legislation, for example, the problem we have is like with the International Convention, there is a gap of implementation. In some places, because it was a commitment, but not necessarily the priority. In some places, because even government wants to do much more, they don't know how to do it. In some places, because the so-called national gender machineries, that's the ministries of women and gender affairs, are usually the most weak politically, and also the less they are under-resourced. So even if they want to do much more, they can't do it. So that's the thing that we have to deal with. But on the other hand, women in countries who were once stayed out of the public arena are now standing side by side with men to demand freedom and rights and dignity and the right to participate in revitalizing their societies. And like 2 weeks ago, I was in Egypt and I had the possibility to share meetings with young women, the so-called women younger like you, who were in Tahrir Square, the so-called Facebook and Twitter generation. I was talking in the morning to a group and saying for me it was an incredible situation because I was in the meeting with them, talking with you, hearing their concerns, sharing points of view. And there are, in the meantime, they were, you know, sending messages in mobile or in their computer. So it was interesting because we were like 25, but we really were much more because we were connecting. So I said that I felt like this was an official WikiLeaks that we were having there, but it was completely official and accepted, so it was great. But on the other hand, and they were of course concerned because they were saying they weren't having at that minute clear where will be their space to reshape their society. But they're working on it, and our people are working on it. But on the other hand, there's a great new, I think, in Tunisia. In Tunisia, two days ago, they made, vote or something, and they decided that in both countries, they will form a constituent assembly, who will be the one who will deliver the new constitution. And in Tunisia, they decided that this constituent assembly will have gender parity. 50% women will be elected and 50% men. And I think that's a great, great news. So I know that change can happen, but in order to do so and not to have to wait for so more decades, we will focus in some specific area. And I really believe that the only possible way for women to have their rights respected is to women have relevance. So that's why for me the important issue is to empower women. And of course empowerment in many dimensions, but there are at least two dimensions because social empowering women are everywhere. Everywhere you go into a disaster relief or you go to visit a country, you will always find women at the grassroots organization. So it's not that women are not present, they are very present, but they're not in the top position, in the decision-making position. So we don't need to empower them where they're already empowered, because they are empowered in the society. We need to empower them where we're still very far away from them. And where is that? Economic empowerment, but also because I do believe that if a woman don't have economic autonomy, it's very difficult to have rights and be sure that the rights will be effective. So we will be working on economic empowerment because we know that women, when women earn their own income, they can challenge the way decisions are made in household. They can demand the right to engage in the political arena. They can claim the right to be safe from violence. but women are still economically marginalized in many countries. In South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, up to 80% of women workers are in some form of vulnerable employment with no benefits or security, low pay, and in many cases, no pay at all. If you look at all the informal employment, I think almost 80% are female. So we have an issue there. We have some other issues that it's not only for developing countries, it's also for developed countries, and also here is the situation of migrant workers or domestic workers. So our mandate is global. It's not only to work with developing countries, it's also to work with developed countries to improve women's conditions of labor, of life. For on the other hand, so we were working from women's workers to see how their labor conditions, they have decent job with decent salary and conditions, to SMEs, micro entrepreneurs, small one, middle one, and how they have access to credit. For example, a very important area is in a rural area where women are, as I mentioned, the leading labor force. But usually they produce very wonderful products, but they can never get out of poverty because they are lacking of so many things. In some places what they need is water supply. In some other places they need storage supplies. And that's why in Liberia we are building two storage warehouse where they can storage their thing, and then where they can go to the market in better condition, because otherwise they have to just sell in any price. We have to give them managerial skills. We have to give them technical transfer so they can add value to their products and so on. So I'm working on that kind of project with other agencies to see how we can help women in terms of their own, building on their own capacities, but giving them a better opportunities. But also we're talking on the corporate sector, because today women are not present in enough representation at important companies. Even though the World Economic Forum has shown clearly for 143 countries that they studied that those with greater gender equality are more competitive and grow faster. But the CEO representation is very low. In this country, I think it's 3% of CEOs are female. And we can advance much more, and also in senior post positions. If I mention that economic empowerment will be one very important one in all that dimension, the other second, and it's not that one is more important, they're all important, is what I would call political empowerment, or we could call it to enhance women's voices, leadership, and participation. The figures are very bad, and this is probably the worst of all the dimensions of women's progress. Only 19% of all the parliamentarians of the world are female. In this country, I believe it's 14%. And when we're talking about 19%, we're talking about Rwanda, that has the biggest one, 54%. The third is South Africa, 44%. Two countries that have almost zero, maybe 0.something%. But on the other hand, and we also, from the 192 member states of the United Nations, right now, we have only 19 female head of states or head of government. So less than 10%. So it's not, it's a little bit sad, I would say. But we're not going to cry, we're going to work. So, and we know what works. Because look, 15 years ago in Beijing, there was this action plan. It was defined that when you need a country to improve gender equality in terms of legislation, you know it, at least a critical mass of 30% female representation in parliament. If you look 15 years after, what do we see? That in the world, 28 countries have achieved that goal. And from those 28 countries, 23 needed specific laws, I would say affirmative actions in terms to achieve that goal. And we can not only 30%, but to increase women's participation in parliament. So, but there are successful stories with quota laws. Albania, for example, doubled the number of women parliamentarians through a quota law to over 16%. Still far from 30%, but double. Nepal attained South Asia's higher ever percentage of women legislators through quota laws, nearly 33%, but up from 2%. So really, quota laws fostered some of the fastest progress in increasing the number of women leaders in many countries. So female participation, leadership, and so on is one important area. The third area that we need to work on is ending violence against women. And this is really widespread. And it does not, I would say, you cannot say it's issue from the developing country, not at all. In the developed country, it's a very important issue. And the difference is that we know even how much it costs. We know how many people, but also how much it costs. And it really costs a lot. So maybe some people don't care about this issue that, in my point of view, is the most pervasive violation of human rights, violence against women, but it's also very expensive for countries. The United States made a lot of studies in the past and discovered that $5.6 billion was the cost of domestic violence because of health, physical health, health care, mental health care, and also productivity loss. Canada made some, that has a very small, smaller population than US, made its own survey, it was $1.6 billion a year. And Australia just made a, I think, a very comprehensive study, included much more consequences. And it was $13.6 billion a year. So it is a very important violation of human rights, but it's also something that is costing countries a very important. So we're working on that, trying to create awareness, to champion against this kind of crimes, if I may say, trying to involve men and boys in this kind of campaign. In many places, we have men, very important football players, very important, if I would say, male role models to be involved in this kind of singers or actors and so on, to be involved. And also, we continue on that, but also we're working on safe cities, so how we can produce the best possible response to that. But there's another issue that's very important for us is women, and that's something that happens elsewhere, that there are some universal issues like climate change, like economical crisis, like war, and everybody suffers, of course, but for some reason or another, women suffer in a very specific way and in a different way, and usually their concerns and their needs are not taken into consideration. So one very important part of our job is how we engage women and women's rights fully in peace and post-conflict processes and in national development planning. During the first UN Assembly in 1946, Eleanor Roosevelt insisted that women should have the opportunity to, and I will quote her, share in the work of peace and reconstruction as they did in war and resistance. She would be disappointed, because when we see what happened in the last 10 years, there was a study at a university of 585 peace agreements concluded between 1990 and 2010. I'm not talking peace agreement since the Second World War. I'm talking on peace agreements since probably after the Cold War ended. They found that just 16% of those peace agreement referred to women at all. I mean, the word women was written in some little corner. And only 3 had a reference to sexual or gender-based violence in a fact that in all this conflict, rape and violence was used as a means of war. We had advanced, you know, the international justice have defined rape in conflict countries as a means of war. The same, the Security Council of the United Nations have defined that it's not only a human, it's also a security issue, but still there's little progress on that. So we will be working with the Department of Political Affairs in developing a program, a 3-year program, developing critical mass of women leaders. We have the mediation skills, negotiation skills, so they can be part of the mediation team, so they can bring the voices of the women there. But because when you are in a peace agreement, the parties that are sitting there have to approve who is going to sit as mediators. We have to understand we will try to have a very important group of women that can be respected, but we cannot impose them. Who will be the mediator? So we'll also be working with men who usually they are former presidents, former foreign ministers or leaders, and they will be working with them so they can also be the voices of the one who don't have voices, of the women. And also we'll be working strengthening the capacities of women's organizations in those countries. And of course we are working right now with Côte d'Ivoire. We have been in the past working with this woman who wanted to call for peace, and now we'll continue now that the Ivory Coast will start its new process to help them also in this reshaping of their society so women can have a voice. And we will have been working a lot in South Sudan. South Sudan in July will be the 193 member state of the United Nations, a new nation. And we have been working, so in their planning, in their programming, women's issues are considered. But we also been working because, you know, rape and violence is used as a means of war. We have been working with the peacekeepers so they can, we have been training pre-deployed forces in terms of they can, you know exactly what to do, have the tactic readiness to hopefully prevent that kind of action, otherwise to respond as soon as possible. And I hope all of these things will be really helpful in trying to bring to these women prevention of this situation, but in case we cannot prevent it, access to justice, no impunity to perpetrators, because there are some situations where women, you know, they were raped, the perpetrators were found, they went to jail, but they escaped from jail. Women win the trials, but never receive a reparation. So we need to continue working also how we redress and reparate these women. And it's very impressive because talking to many of these women, they not necessarily want individual or material reparation. Some of them, these women have told you, just this case where the guys escaped, they wanted a collective reparation. And they asked for a boat, for a ship, a little ship, a boat. Because then they didn't have to go to the market through the roads that were danger, or where they're raped, they could go through the river. So they didn't want something specific for them, but some for the group, for the community. On some other women, one amazing woman, she has been raped so many times, when they ask her in this audience with the High Commission of Human Rights about this issue, it's in front of their own citizens. She said, I don't want any money at all. The only reparation that I need is that you understand that my rape is not my problem. It's your problem. It's the society's problem. I think that's a wonderful attitude and of somebody. And now she's working in shelters to provide support for women. Because they not only were raped, but usually what happens is that they're stigmatized by the community. If they are pregnant because of the rape, they're abandoned by their husband. So it's a real social drama. And afterwards, what they need sometimes is help to be able to provide food and incomes to their families. So it's a very important issue. Well, we will be working on other areas that are so important, like education. For example, the difference in a girl's future will be that they finish school. And we've seen that as much school retention there is smaller risk for early pregnancy, for early marriage, for forced marriage, for HIV/AIDS, and so on. So we'll be working with UNICEF, with UNESCO, and some others to see how we can ensure that girls will really study and complete studies. In health, of course, we will be working with the whole of the rest of the system, not only trying to bring down this maternal mortality rate, but also to ensure women's health and women's rights on health issues. On migration, we will be working with the rest of the organization. In HIV/AIDS, of course, too, we need to ensure universal access to IRB, and we need to ensure prevention methods, and we need to ensure also how we can prevent maternal transmission to the babies and so on. So there's many areas where we are been working, so whether we have a lot of challenges. So as you can see, there's a lot of challenges, a lot of work, but also progress made. but we still have a long way to go in order to advance in gender equality and women's empowerment. Because women deserve it. We all deserve to have rights, opportunities, but also because the world needs it. I have to tell you that I'm always impressed of the strength and the capacity of those women in the most difficult circumstances, but with an incredible resilience, with an incredible spirit that they want to, you know, stand up and continue going on. And I think the challenges are enormous, but we'll work with all our energy. And with commitment and with the support of everybody, we will succeed. And of course, I'm here because I hope that you will, when we finish this activity, you will all go out, say, we are all UN women. Thank you very much. Are you too, Harvey, you and women?
I certainly am. Let me begin with good news and better news. The good news is we've collected an awful lot of very good questions from the audience and over the internet. The better news is, to do justice to these questions, we have to have Michelle Bachelet back in Berkeley soon. So let me begin, and what I'm going to do is group several questions together to begin. So I will start with three from the audience. And they're a little diverse. First, what would you respond to those who claim that women's rights are Western values and therefore not universal? Second, how can U.S. activists bring home the human rights provided under CEDAW when ratification faces stiff opposition in the UN Senate? Is ratification the only mechanism for change? And third, I'm only reading the last line of the question, what are the limits of UN Women's mandate?
Well, I think it's not for me to respond to those who claim that women's rights are Western values, because I think that we have seen in the other world is clearly a clear answer to that. I mean, I spoke with those women, they weren't Western at all, and they wanted opportunities, they wanted their rights. Of course, there can be different perspective of what you think is for example, there are things, I mean, for me, the right is the right to have the possibility of developing, to take your own decisions, to take your own choices. And maybe the choices of some cultures could be different than others. But the important thing is that people have the right to make their own choices, that really have their own choices, with their own independence and with enough information so they can do the right choices for them. So I'm not interested in imposing anybody some one only specific result, because there are issues that can be different. But I have to tell you, I don't believe that it's a Western value to think that female genital mutilation is right. I don't believe there's no religion at all who would sustain something like that. And we have the experience in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. We work with religious leaders. Our people were looking at the Quran with them and really showing, and no more than showing, understanding that there's no place in the Quran that says that women can be harmed. And today, they're the most enthusiastic leaders on the campaign against FGM, working with the communities, because FGM is not an issue of religion, it's an issue of social norms. And what they are working on those places, how to change those social norms. because people who perform FGM doesn't do it to harm the girls. It's because they believe that girl will have better possibility to get married, to be considered pure, and so on. So it's a social norm. It's more. It's not something different. And I had experience in this refugee camp to talk to a woman who was old, and she told me, I have performed thousands of FGM in my life. And I did it because my great-grandmother did it, my grandmother did it, my grandmother teach my mother teach me, and I did it until I realized that this was harmful for the girls. So I can tell you, I can be very open in some areas where there can be some cultural differences, but anything that really harms women's, not only physically, mentally, or their opportunities, I don't believe this is Western. I believe this is universal values. There are other things that can be cultural driven, and I have no problem at all with that, if women's rights and opportunities are really being a reality. In terms of how can US activists bring home the human rights, well, I'm not supposed to talk on specifics, but of course, CEDAW is a convention. It could be ratified and not implemented. So of course, it's better to ratify a convention because it is a framework that really can ensure different women's rights in terms of the kind of access to all the services that a human being needs, from health, education, job facilities, and in all dimensions of life. But I believe that I believe in any issue, and particularly when you are dealing with policymakers, and particularly when you're dealing with parliamentarians care of their constituencies. So it's very important that women who do believe the ratification of certain conventions like CEDAW or some other is important. It's very important to organize and to do bottoms up, try to build the influence so those parliamentarians really feel that they will have a cost if they don't vote for it. It's not easy. You know, the discussion of budget has had a very important issue on family planning, on parenthood planning, so it's not an easy issue. But I do believe that what you cannot do is give up. And women's organizations have to organize themselves collectively, put together, and have a strong voice. And how in this country you also have challenges, not the same challenges that in Africa or in Asia or in Latin America, but you do have challenges, and you do need to stand out for that challenges. And one is the CEDAW Convention, but others is how to be ensure, how are you treating in this country migrant workers, domestic workers, foreign people. You have to look. You will find your own challenges. And in terms of CEDAW, I think civil society is the answer, and people need to get together and work with the parliamentarians and produce this. Produce the influence that the constituencies has to produce. Okay. The limits. There's no limits now. The only limit, if I may say, is that, but it's not a limit really. It's this task of that we are not the ones who are going to do everything. So more than a limit, I don't know, many of you are young, but I have to tell you that coordination is probably one of the most difficult issues. I don't know if you have had to make teamwork and you have to coordinate a lot of people to do something. It takes time, and sometimes the result is not as good as you would like to. So we need to coordinate a lot and produce synergies on the whole system. And synergy means to put a lot of people together to try to think what we're going to do in common, but what we're going to do each of us by our own capacity, who is going to do what, how we're going to put money together. That's probably the most difficult thing. And how we're going to push together to get the real outcome on gender equality and women's empowerment. So it's not a limit, I think it's a challenge. But limits we do not have, because as a mandate. But of course, the limit is that even though I spoke about the main priorities, the situation of women is very different from one region to the other region in the world. There are some universal issues, common issues, but on the other hand, there are different realities. So our challenge is to how in every country and in every region we are able to do what is needed to be done, but it's also what is needed to be done not only because we from you in New York go there and tell them this is the important thing to do, but mainly how we are able to work with our national partners and identify their own priorities and support their own priorities. Because I believe that in terms of really changing the world for the better for women, ownership of the changes are essential. And again, Egypt, I want to give it as an example. I mean, people are very proud of their revolution because it's made in within. And I believe in Egypt, they have, do they have some questions about Egypt or can
no,
I?
No,
oh, so I can speak about
right
it.
Okay. It.
They have at least two big challenges. I'm talking not on gender issue, I'm talking about countries who are facing this situation. And the first challenge, of course, is transit to democracy. And that has a lot of different areas and dimensions. The political, more typical political dimension, in terms of analyzing which is the kind of regime they're gonna develop. Because, for example, in Chile, there is a very presidentialist regime. Of course, it's not an authoritarian presidentialist regime, but president is a very important figure there. In other places, in Europe, you have parliamentary system, semi-parliamentary system, and so many different alternatives. But because they come from a country where there was a very strong presidentialist system, this is not something they are looking with good eyes. But on the other hand, they don't have a very strong parliamentary system. So they need to look at the options on what kind of political regimes there are and try to find out which is the best for them. How they can also improve the political party system, electoral laws, and so on. And also in that sense, democracy, not only as I discussed today in the morning in its origin, that you decide who your people will represent you, but also in terms of what democracy is. And democracy speaks of pluralism, inclusiveness. So part of the democratic transition is how their societies in Egypt and Tunisia will ensure women's participation and women's rights, because that's what democracy is about. I mean, women I mentioned, but any other group doesn't have, could be ethnic groups in some places, disabled people, I mean, all the groups that are not really with a real, an equal representation. So that's, I would say, the challenge, political challenge. And the other big challenge is that democracy has to deliver. And one of the reasons of the revolution was not only the political issue, it was also the economical issue. Because in the Arab world, you have very well-educated young people, but with a big unemployment and not highly educated, particularly women. In the tertiary education, the rate of women versus men is higher, but many of those women never have a job. So there is a lot of disappointment also in terms of future perspective, but also in terms of poverty. There's a lot of people who are really poor. There's a big illiteracy rate, and women are, of course, the majority. So I would say the second big and very urgent challenge is what they call to bring social justice. They don't like the word social protection. They believe this is a World Bank concept. that's what they told me. Eh? So they don't like it. But they like social justice and of course, jobs. So I believe these are the main two challenges now. And that's why there's a lot of attention given, and I believe a lot in South-South cooperation because South America went to this process. And there are different ways of doing it. But also South Africa, for example, or also Eastern Europe, or Indonesia, or Portugal and Spain. So there's a lot of alternatives that I think the most important thing for them is not to start creating the wheel, because we created a long time ago, and we know what mistakes we have done, so we can try to help them avoid mistakes that we already did in many of our countries, and then for them to choose what they're gonna do. So that's why, and I mention this because I think if you want to help in a process that is a historical momentum for women in particular, but for all the people, is to provide and share experience so they can make their own decisions. And that's the way that I intend to work with all the countries and our national partners. It could be a limitation in some minutes. I don't believe it's a limitation, because I believe that processes has to be sustainable, cannot be the response of a minute, and then change the government, change everything. So that's why it's very important that we work understanding the culture, the circumstances, and try to make it for the better.
Unfortunately, we have a time constraint, okay. So we are going to go to a final, very brief round of questions. And before we do this final, very brief round, I want to thank the people who work at the Center for Latin American Studies and the volunteers who work on this event. Starting with our new vice chair, Dionisia Ramos, and I, in particular, I want to thank Michelle Bachelet for truly a heroic effort to be with us today. She is between Nigeria and an early trip tomorrow morning to Panama City. So with that in mind, we have time for, we're going to have two very brief questions to conclude. The first is, you are such an amazing woman. When you get the free time to just relax, what do you do? And the final question may in fact be related to this. What are the challenges in raising resources for women's rights? How do you address them, and how can we help?
Well, the question of brief question was a brief answer, please. That's what we're saying, then. Free time? Not much. And the first thing I have to do is laundry. Because I could be former president, but I'm a normal person. I do everything that you do. And I feel more like a student, I have to say. No, I haven't had much time to relax, and everybody envies me and say, wow, live in New York City, the city who never sleeps. And I said, I'm exhausted, I want to sleep. So we're not aligned with New York City yet, but I hope we'll get the time, because I love music, and I've only been able to go in all these months. I've been from since October in New York. I've all been able to, well, in September I went, but I came back then to a Shakira concert, of course. and then to a jazz concert of a marvelous pianist. He was 84 years old, and he's a great jazz man, and he's the one who has organized a lot of jazz festivals in many places. So. That was great. And the third only other issue in all this month is I went to see a play in Broadway with some good friends, Professor Harley and Beatrice Mann, that it was a movie I saw when I was young, and I love it, and it's West Side Story, and it was a great opportunity. I really enjoyed it. And it's funny because now it's in English and Spanish, because there's so much Spanish people, living people in the U.S. What are the challenges in raising resources for women's rights? How do you address them? How we can help? I would say the challenges is that today's world is not the best moment to ask for money. Because of the financial crisis, everybody, I mean, usually there were donors, I mean, countries or governments who gave money. But they're all very constrained and limited because of financial crisis, but also because they have to respond to their constituencies. Many of them have had to cut benefits inside their countries, and people don't understand international cooperation. If I ask you, for example, how much money do you believe the government of the United States gives to international organizations, to the UN? How much do you think? Well, maybe you know better because you are university students and teachers. But the majority of the US citizens believe it's 20% of the budget. I have to tell you, it's something like 0.04%. So, and it's going to be cut, probably. But what I mean to say is that the environment that we have financial is not easy. But of course, it depends also on, in sometimes, in the countries that that's possible, on political will. And I have to say it because the Spanish government, you have seen how much difficulties they have been having in their economic situation. Even that, they continue being the more important donors, the Spanish, the Norwegians, the Canadians. The US, I hope it will be like the fourth or the fifth, I'm not sure, but they're trying to do a big effort, and that's very good. But that's an issue. So we do believe that the way to confront this is not to give up. The other problem is that in the past, sometimes the countries and the donors felt that some of the UN organizations were not very effective. They're not report about the outcomes. So they also couldn't go back to their constituencies and say, look, I cut your health, I cut your education, I cut your pensions. But look, it was worthwhile because look, women and girls in the world are living better. So I do have a great responsibility on, first of all, be more effective, efficient, be more relevant to the women's and girls' life. So that means we have to prioritize very well what we're doing in every country. And we also need to report clearly because everybody, of course, I understand the responsibility. So that's another challenge. And it's a complicated challenge because what I discovered when I came to the UN, there was no common gender tracker or gender marker. So when I ask how much money is the UN system spending on women, I don't have the answer. So now we're developing that, a common gender tracker marker, so we will know how much is every organization. It will take some time, but we'll know that. But we will also be able to, and then we have to think, okay, now we know how much money, but what impact are we having with this? How relevant are? And I believe that if UN Women really wants to do its job, what we need to do is to be relevant. As I think the UN needs to continue being relevant for the people in the world, because that's the way donors and the people will support, continue supporting this very important task, this very important and noble task. I have to tell you something, because usually don't probably, when I lived in my country, I thought that in UN you didn't work that much. And I was completely wrong. I have to tell you, because that's important to know, that people really work a lot, very hard, and in very hard conditions. You know what happened in Afghanistan, you know? How these seven people who were killed there, the Nepalese who were beheaded by the manifestation, and the three international functionaries of UN who were killed there. So people really does a lot of sacrifice, personal sacrifice, and works a lot. And I have to tell you, it's so beautiful to see so many young people like you volunteering and working in so many places for the rest of the world. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing to do, and it gives you strength and spirit. What can you do to help me? Well, you can sign the checks outside. But if you cannot do that, please be the champions of the women's rights and the girls' rights, because I'm sure, I'm so convinced when women and girls are better, men and boys are also better. The whole society is better.